Welcome, everyone. My name is Scott Shepherd. I'm the founder and host of the City's First podcast and really thrilled to have with us today. I believe this is our 20th episode now with Rick Adamski. Rick Adamski is the president of Ash and Lime in Texas. I believe it's in Dallas, Texas. So, Rick, welcome to the podcast today. How are you doing?
Thank you so much. I'm doing well. It's great to be here. And 20 is a great accomplishment. I made it
Yes.
to 12 in my podcast.
Yeah.
And
It's
it
awesome. Yeah.
ended up,
There's
oh, that's right. I was just going to say it ended up, COVID ended up hitting, and we did some great episodes, but we just kind of had to move on to other things. So, but I would love to do one again. And 20 is a great accomplishment, especially because you've had some good interviews and so forth.
Thank you, Rick. Yeah, 20, and we're on our second year, third, almost in our third season. So yeah, we're plugging ahead here. We just do these episodes like once a month. Everyone knows the format. Each episode's about 30, 35 minutes due to kind of Zoom constraints as a Zoom recording. And with that, we'll just kind of get started with our normal format and kind of our kind of high level questions, and we'll have just a nice conversation exchange. So with that, I'm going to start with Rick with your bio, and then we'll just jump right in. So with that, about you. So where some see forgotten places, Rick Adamski sees extraordinary opportunities and is dedicated to supporting extraordinary places where people thrive. As the president of Ash and Lime, Rick has consulted on over 40 pro 50 projects across 35 towns and cities, focusing on downtown and neighborhood planning, local economic development, support for small developers, and deep stakeholder engagement. His approach is bottom up and incremental, providing communities with tools and resources to achieve immediate, productive steps towards tangible results using their current resources. Rick earned his master's degree in urban planning and policy from the University of Illinois at Chicago School of Architecture and a BA, Bachelor of Arts, in sociology from the University of Cincinnati. Rick has consulted for several of the most prominent planning organizations in the United States before moving to Texas and embracing a more nimble, actionable, and participatory approach to developing communities. So with that, Rick, we welcome you here. We're really excited to have you, and let's get going here.
Sure,
So
just one
yeah,
correction. I did go to the School of Planning instead of the School of Architecture, but
yes, I think you're right. You're talking about for University of Illinois, Chicago, correct?
yes, that's right. Yeah,
Thank
but
you.
other than that, that sounds like a fine enough description. Yeah.
Yes, it's a different school. Yes, my bad. Okay, so we'll get started here. So our first question is kind of around the theme we just described around your bios. Tell us about how you approach public engagement and equity in Texas towns and communities. Let's focus on Texas to start.
Okay. Yeah, and most of my work so far has been in Texas, although that is, I believe, going to change, and we're going to be expanding in a lot of other places. Public engagement, the if I could just say one phrase that would be most important to me, it's to look at synonyms of the word engage. We spend a very unusual amount of time on engagement. We do with our projects a lot of the standard things. You get everybody into a room. We might, certainly do it a little bit differently, but the idea is you have the key stakeholders in the room, you talk about goals and objectives, you figure out what your next steps are based on that, and it helps to inform your plan. A lot of our magic that we do ends up being in more informal engagements. We typically work on the scale of the downtown, the neighborhood, and the corridor, or the district, the neighborhood, the corridor, we'll say. At that scale, the things that you can do immediately make a lot of difference. And the people who are there, the specific dynamics of the people who are there make a difference. And the best way to get progress done, instead of making plans that sit on the shelf for 10 years until the next plan comes, is to figure out how to give people tools and resources that they can use to improve their places. So you're still making recommendations to the city, you're still hoping that those recommendations take place. But to have very active engagement, you have to try to dig into the people who aren't necessarily showing up at the meetings. You have to find those people. Then B, to the extent possible, you find the most enthusiastic people and figure out ways that they can make a difference in their own community, whether it's figuring out ways that they can volunteer, whether they, as business owners, may be able to apply some strategies that could get people coming in at different times. Maybe it's somebody who owns a vacant building or a vacant lot and figure out ways to bring activity into those lots. So when we say engage, we say, you know, we want to make people as actively involved and immersed within their community and give them the tools that they need to take the next steps. And when we've done that, in many cases, we've had really extraordinary and quick successes. So that's kind of the way that we look at engagement. The way that we look at equity, I think, is to treat every community is different, but every community, you have to operate under the same principles. So you treat, you know, in all cases, what you're doing is saying, what is here and what are the tools that we need to help take the next step? And especially being conscious about how does this impact people who may be more vulnerable? How can we emphasize with people who may be more vulnerable? And how can we make our recommendations based on that? And, you know, obviously vulnerability can mean a lot of things. That can mean somebody who might not have access to a car. That might be somebody who might not feel safe walking in a particular neighborhood. That might be somebody who has a disability that limits their ability to to get around a place. So figuring out, having very much in mind those people and working to empathize with them in the planning efforts.
Yeah, it's all about empathy, but getting back to engagement, leveling the playing field so that noisy 5% in community meetings doesn't basically dominate the conversation, as we well know in the urban planning field.
Uh-huh.
But then also on the equity side, really, like you had mentioned, having empathy to kind of reach out, understand the pain points, and not taking a one-size-fits-all approach. So these are all relevant to anyone who's passionate about cities and communities and helping them be resilient from now and into the future. So it's great lessons that you've shared with us here.
I would just add one more thing, if I may. In both of those, kind of the key to both of those in a lot of ways is bottom-up. There's some
absolutely.
Decisions that obviously have to be made top-down, but you work bottom-up, you work with the people who are there, and you figure out what resources they need to do the next thing. So that is really important for meaningful engagement, but that's also very important for equity, that you're not just saying, here's the $100 million or $500 million project, but what are things that we can actually do and what are things that people can do that with resources that actually exist, not with something imaginary in the plan, that can start to move the needle soon.
I love it. Yeah, it's flipping the script in terms of, let's say, mid 20th century, top down urban planning, or these kind of landmark, you know, stadium or facilities projects, and really getting to what matters for communities and neighborhoods. So it's really, really great to hear that. Very refreshing. I think our audience will take some great lessons from that. Our next question is around kind of following along this theme around tactical urbanism. So how can tactical urbanism reactivate neighborhoods and communities? I believe there's a little bit of overlap between this and the previous question, but, you know, if you want to expand on that.
Sure. We've worked on projects that are tactical urbanism, and some of which have been very transformative. So for example, here in Dallas, we had the national conference for the CNU, Congress for the New Urbanism, come by. It's been 9 years ago now. Time goes fast. Mm-hmm. And in this particular case, I happened to live and work in the neighborhood that we were doing a big project in. It was Crowdis Plaza, where there was essentially this underutilized block in this very kind of intense urban neighborhood in Dallas. And we figured out how to make it temporarily into a plaza because we believed that it could happen. So it was 4 days. People had a really good time, but it also helped to open up possibilities in a lot of ways. We were hoping perhaps that within 9 years that the city would have simply pedestrianized the space. They have not ended up doing that, but there have been steps taken toward humanizing the space, whether it's the fact that there's string lights out, whether there's the fact that there's been some infrastructure changes, and the fact that people are, whenever there's a market or something, they use that block and they demonstrate the possibilities of it. Also, for example, we had some musical, some space for performers during that. And later than that, after that, you had these buskers, these, you know, just people who are street performers that started showing up for months and months after in a way that they hadn't before. So we saw these subtle changes being made in ways that we didn't expect. In this particular case, I've seen tactical urbanism transform places radically. In this particular case, maybe it's left behind a place that's 20% better. But that's pretty cool, right? Yep. To be able to do that based on a temporary project. I think the most important thing is that the ideas of tactical urbanism, so we think of making short-term, temporary, experimental changes that demonstrate or move towards long-term visions and goals. The first thing is it's not separate from project delivery as a whole. So, and it's not a thing that you do on the side. It's if you see, let's say that you see, okay, this is, we'll go back to whatever it is. We've seen many situations where we say, this block doesn't seem like it needs to be for automobiles. Maybe this can be pedestrianized, but A, there's not a lot of public support for it. And B, let's test the idea out. Let's not make a huge, you know, we saw what happened in the 80s when we just went and pedestrianized a bunch of main streets and it didn't work out for us. So, you know, let's test the idea. Let's see if it works at low cost and low risk. And if it works, let's keep going. That to me is the important thing. So the umbrella of tactical urbanism is a set of tools. In some cases, it's an appropriate set of tools. In other cases, it's not necessarily the set of tools that you need. The biggest question is, what are your goals? And what is the next step that you can take that can move you towards your goals? And tactical urbanism is under that umbrella, but in some other cases, it may be that you come to the conclusion that, you know, what you have to do most is to organize your downtown business association and to get the downtown business association to be more effective. Or it may be that you have a small business development center and they need to be working better with the Chamber of Commerce in order to hit the next step. It may be that there are some small developers in town, the people who own property, people who own land, but they need to get a little bit more training in order to be effective. So you figure out how to get the training to the people. The point is never one set of tools. It's not, hey, we've got a hammer, so we're going to make everything into a nail. The point with all of this stuff is to figure out what the next step is and take it and move toward the goals and to try things without betting the farm on it. Going back to the example of the, you know, the street shutdowns that we had where we shut down our main streets and pedestrianized them and they turned out to be very disastrous. We could have done that once a month and then gradually said, okay, we're going to put out some bollards. We're going to, shut some things down. We're going to do some pavement treatments and try it for an entire month and see what happens. That's the point to be made for all of these things.
Yeah, the spirit is experimentation and doing it in a way that affects and is a catalyst for change. It's not like, let's say, I don't know if you want to call it a means to an end, but really it's one of many different methods that can be used to kind of improve our public spaces and communities. And I think that what you'd mentioned in terms of some of these learnings, what resonated with me is you're talking about these 1970s, 1980s pedestrian malls. And what comes to mind for me is I think the only one that was deemed quote unquote a success, in urban planning circles is of course the Church Street Marketplace in Burlington, Vermont. My former stomping grounds, because I'm a graduate of University of Vermont. I spent about 10 years there. But, that Church Street Marketplace example has simply not been replicated across North America, US or Canada. If you look at like Fresno, California, others are a complete failure. So yeah, I mean, we've learned a lot, hard lessons, and we know how to do this better. Albeit maybe with some of the COVID shutdowns and maybe some of the car-free, open streets projects in the US weren't quite as maybe positive as we'd like to see, or we've reverted back to auto centricity, but maybe done in a different fashion, like you had suggested, maybe just once a month or incrementally, we could have seen different results. So, you know, it kind of begs the question, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, generally speaking, where pedestrianization has been successful, for example, it turns out to be where you already have a lot of pedestrians. Yes.
So that's Burlington.
And where the pedestrians tend to push, where it tends to force the issue.
That's right.
So whether that's, in several examples, in college towns. But if you talk about, you know, you've got cases in, you know, downtown Las Vegas, right? Like there, that's been very successful. You have Fremont Street. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, there's lots of places like that.
Yeah.
You have, you know, Miami is and so forth. I think Minneapolis, they might have changed it back at Nicollet Mall, but that was successful back in the day.
And what about, I'm trying to think of San Diego too. Well, you have the Gas Lamp Quarter, but that's not pedestrianized, but that potentially could be though. When I think about that, it's kind of near the Petco Park in the Central Business District, downtown San Diego, but I'm just
going. I'm sure there's places that could, and I mean, more recently there's places that have, you know, and if you want to take an extreme example, but there's, you know, if you want to take an extreme example, think of the pedestrianization of Times Square.
I was just going to say, yeah, Manhattan. Yeah, of course.
They did some, and there's other places in Manhattan that's not happened. So they did some research beforehand, but the real key to the whole thing is that they tested it out temporarily and that they literally put out lawn chairs and saw what happened and were able to observe the traffic. You've got a case in Los Angeles right now where they're spending, I think, something along the lines of $1.5 million to do studies about one block that dead ends that's alongside a park that they're looking at pedestrianizing. I mean, it's just, you know, you could literally put out cones and see what happens, or put out bollards.
And spend no money.
And
does he even have a budget in the first place?
Yeah. I mean, you need a budget to, you know, you need to measure things that happen, right? You need to figure out what happens with traffic. Like, let's have the humility to understand that it might not work, but just to do these studies that are going to tell you much less doing the experiment.
Yeah. You know, that comes back to the legacy of the formalization of the urban planning process, the top down kind of the over like siloed institutionalization. And really, it should be about sweat equity, just taking notes and learning and observing and just getting out in the community. It's funny you mentioned the example in Los Angeles, but kind of across the pond over here in Europe, which is where I'm speaking from, you know, I think one of the best examples is the shift towards active mobility and transportation and pedestrianization of the urban core in Brussels. In Brussels, Belgium was one of the most auto-centric cities in all of Europe, other than Rotterdam, Netherlands, you know, in the 20th century, after kind of the reconstruction after the Second World War. And, you know, Brussels was so auto-centric, basically copied a lot of North American cities in terms of being very auto-dependent. And what we've seen during and since COVID has been such a rapid reconfiguration of the city center with bollards, with, you know, other kind of treatments. And it is the largest pedestrian zone in Europe right now. And basically, Paris gets most of the attention in terms of being a cycle-friendly city and being very, you know, let's say, focused towards active mobility. But I think more attention should be placed on Brussels and some other mid-sized European cities, because that's really where we're seeing a huge transformation, in addition to examples that you had mentioned, perhaps in Dallas and US cities that are doing it incrementally. But I just wanted to share that with the audience and went off on a tangent. So.
Well, that's great. You know, it's so depressing to see that in New York City, where, you know, the least car dependency that we have, you have this outdoor dining park program that appears to basically have been canceled after it seems to have been successful. And it's, you know, overall, it's really disheartening to me the level of changes that we did not make as a society during COVID, the level of adjustments that we did make. And that's in a lot of ways, you know, we should have rethought a lot of priorities at places. Before COVID, I used to always say, if you were to pour millions of dollars into your Main Street, but you lost your, you know, five or six best small businesses and they weren't replaced, nothing that you would do matters. And that remains the case, but it's amazing that cities don't seem to have learned that from COVID, because it's obvious. You're not, if you don't have the great little mom and pop businesses, nothing that you do downtown is going to matter. And of course, we don't focus on giving these places support the way that we likely could. So it's a bummer that we have not done more. In the case of my neighborhood in Dallas, we are very blessed because I live in the Bishop Arch neighborhood in Dallas, and they put out these parklets. Jason Roberts, who's known from Better Block and some other people, put out parklets and outdoor seating, and then it was copied by other people. And it's been left out there. You know, they asked for forgiveness rather than permission, I guess, but I don't think they ever asked for forgiveness for it. And it's still there. And it's really, really benefits the neighborhood. There's a lot of different outdoor seating. There are huge parking shortages in this neighborhood. And to the credit of everybody, there hasn't been a demand to replace these with parking spaces. In a much more car dependent city than New York, certainly. And in a district where most people who go there get there by car, they've still managed to keep those parklets out. So it's one of those things that I find to be pleasantly surprising, but I don't find that cities overall gained a lot of the many lessons that they could have from COVID, including the fact that, including thinking of themselves as having financial vulnerabilities that they need to prepare for. I think there was so much money that came to compensate for COVID. I don't think cities have seen, well, maybe if something like this happens again, there won't be the money. So how do we adjust the way that we think? That's not, just unfortunately, not in most cities' DNA.
Yeah. Well, yeah. In North America, you know, it's just, it's interesting.
Yeah. In North America.
Yeah. So we had this glimmer of hope of kind of ameliorating and pushing back all these poor urban planning policy decisions in the 20th century. And, you know, for about 12 to 24 months, it seemed like we were making progress, you know, like, but then it was ultimately a case in US, maybe some parts of Canada, of two steps forward, you know, four steps, five steps backwards in a way. But there are glimmers of hope, like you mentioned, in Dallas and other cities where some of these changes have taken root and lasted. But again, getting back to the case study, which is, I don't want to call it cliche, but it's become well known now in terms of Times Square in New York City. That plus Paris and other cities, I think, get a little bit too much attention due to the US, UK global media cycle. And I think it's these more small to mid-level cities throughout the US, Canada, and Europe that have really seen a much more net positive improvement in the built environment and public spaces that aren't getting enough attention. And I think those are the lessons that can be learned and drawn to help other cities show how to do it. And not only that, just to mention, you know, our previous guest was Enrique Peñalosa, talking about great examples in Latin America. And I think he was a little bit too humble and kind of playing up, you know, Latin America and what's going on there. But I think if we look at Colombia, if we look at Mexico, we look at other countries, they're doing it right. I mean, you look at Medellin, you look at Cartagena, look at Mexico City on a neighborhood scale. We need to be looking at the global South more. We need to be looking at even Africa and parts of Asia. So, yeah, there's such a tapestry of learnings that we can do in our collective knowledge in this post-COVID environment.
I agree with that. What I do think is, in terms of sort of bottom-up type of thinking, and there's a lot, you know, when I go to towns and cities in Texas, that is the only time you will hear me bring up New York City. I don't bring up New York City. Otherwise, I don't bring up Paris. I don't bring up Europe.
Yeah, I stopped talking about this too. So I don't even talk about New York or Paris. I'm like, why?
No, I work in small towns in Texas. In many cases, I mean, I've worked in Dallas and Fort Worth and Houston, but I've worked in places with, you know, even in Dallas, I'm not going to bring up a European city. Mm-hmm. But one thing that, so I'm going to try to find something that, you know, we can directly relate to. In a lot of cases, it's finding things in smaller communities. Mm-hmm. But the place that I will point to, that, because more than, there are certainly lessons that the U.S. can learn from Europe. There are certainly lessons that the U.S. can learn from Latin America and from, to use a really broad brush term, global South.
Yeah.
That's, you know, But there's lessons for that. What I find to be fascinating about a place that has really embraced this bottom-up approach is Australia and New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I find it so fascinating is because those are the places in the world that are built and function most like North American cities, most like U.S. and Canadian cities.
You're right.
And, you know, I haven't been there, right? But I'm following and talking to and communicating with a lot more people from there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I see things that happen in those two countries as being more directly relatable to the United States.
Indeed.
And
yes,
they are not, from what I can figure out, I still have to go, but I think that they are using this type of approach in their small towns, in their native communities, big cities and neighborhoods. I think that they have really embraced it. And I think that, you know, that may largely be a function of when you have a certain amount of professionals and you have these places with very limited populations, you know, they end up kind of inundating it because there's nowhere else for them to go. Mm-hmm. Easily. Oh, that's kind of culturally similar. Whereas we have such a slate here. I can do, you know, I could work in Texas for my whole career, right?
Yeah.
I'd be fine.
You can go down that rabbit hole in Texas, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I am really trying to understand more. I've actually made a point, for example, as I've got more active on LinkedIn, to reach out to people in those places. And it's just astounding. They're just not letting places go. And they are, you know, a place like New Zealand, mm-hmm. That hires, you know, street plans collaborator Mike Lydon and Tony Garcia over there, mm-hmm. you know, they're hiring them to look at the whole country.
Mm-hmm.
Now I would have to observe, you know, it may be that if you are doing things on the scale of a country, even a country of 5 million, it may be that could be a sterilizing force in some ways. I don't know. But I think of, you know, in that part of the world, you know, you have literally Christchurch, New Zealand, that was kind of destroyed by an earthquake, and you use these more kind of, we might call it tactical solutions to you know, kind of temporarily rebuild it. So dealing with real problems, or the stuff that they've done over there with storefronts and with just kind of placemaking techniques, that's one place that I happen to be looking at a lot right now that I see as largely replicable for us.
That's a really good point. And I think that the audience will take a lot of value from that in terms of kind of their practice and what they're looking at and, you know, what fits in their community. So yeah, thanks for sharing about that. Kind of the similarities and differences of Australia and New Zealand, how that could be relevant to, you know, American communities. I think we have time for maybe one or two more questions. I'm going to try to fit and get back to the script here.
Okay, fine.
Let's see here. So another question I wanted to pose to you is, what are the building blocks for thriving public spaces and third places, of which you are an expert in third places? So we want to hear your take on that.
I think that the first building block, I would say, the first answer I would say comes from Project for Public Spaces and what they call the Power of 10 Plus. So having a lot of things for people to do in a place. So that's basically the idea that if you're in a place, you have 10 plus things to do. You can also scale it to the, you know, the district. You have 10 plus places to go into the downtown. Mm-hmm. But the idea is having a lot of options for people to do things. So, you know, and that can apply to public spaces, or that can apply to the third places. There's a lot of overlap between the two. The idea of, you know, a park or something like that is a public space. A third place might be, you know, an indoor place like a community center or a coffee house or a pub. So to give you an example of that applies directly to third places, if I go into a bookstore, mm-hmm. and I see that they have a little place where someone can drink coffee for a quarter, and I see that they have a little chess set up, and I see that they have a little corner for kids where they can sit, that indicates to me that you have a great third place. So that's part of it. I think that making sure that you are figuring out how to be welcoming to different people at different times, having a lot of different activities and activations. Mm-hmm. I think those are all building blocks. There are certainly design building blocks, especially when it comes to public spaces. Things like having a set of, you know, sense of enclosure. Again, things like having little nooks and crannies. You want to have places that are open for different moods at different times. My favorite public space my favorite third place that I like to bring up in Dallas is a bookstore in my neighborhood that's called Wild Detectives. It's actually a bookstore, a coffee house, and a bar, and they also sell vinyl records. Why is it such a great place? There's a few reasons, but one is this building block of there's a lot of different things to do and there's a lot of different nooks and crannies. You can sit, you know, you have an outside, you have an inside, you have an outside in the back. You have areas where it's easier to work on your computer. You have a bar. You have areas where you can sit on couches and talk to people. And you have areas where you can sit alone, right? So it's like, again, almost this concept of the power of 10. There's lots of, you know, you can go in there to buy books. You can go in there to have a drink. You can go in there to drink coffee. So things like that make it more of an inclusive space and more of a place that brings in a lot of different people for different moods at different times of the day. So I would say those are examples of ways that you create a good third place, kind of a home away from home. And similar principles can be applied to public spaces, which, you know, a park or a plaza or a green, which should also be kind of a home away from home in another sense.
Yeah. And as you know, our concept of space, you know, kind of evolves over time. I like to see it as kind of getting back to basics. You know, I mean, if we, you know, draw upon examples that have been written by Jane Jacobs and others around kind of a constant use of space, you know, over a time and place, and really kind of the, like you mentioned, this this activation so that it's not for a single use or purpose, which is what we see in a lot of central business districts and downtowns, why we had that kind of urban death loop thing happening. I don't know if it's still happening, but you know, the concept is out there, and you know, kind of having all of our eggs in one basket, these single use cities, single use districts. I mean, that's kind of like the kiss of death, right? I mean, that's kind of, if we look at American Rust Belt cities, you know, they were single use towns, you know, company towns, but, you know, million person company towns. So if you don't have this diversity of uses economically, socially, whatever, then you're setting yourself up for tough times ahead when consumer trends and just demographics and, you know, the world changes around you, basically.
Detroit was once, well, perhaps the richest city in the United States.
Mm-hmm. And in the 1920s or 30s, yeah.
Yeah, and maybe even, perhaps even after that. But of course, they were completely dependent on three companies in one industry. So, you know, that
you read my mind. Wealth for a time.
Yeah, that, it creates an enormous amount of wealth. And then when that wealth isn't there, it collapses and they don't have much to fall back on. And they end up being a monoculture. So
yes, monoculture.
Yeah, having a diversity, and you know, Jane Jacobs would have pointed to even a diversity of income levels, which is much harder to have in the city. Mm-hmm. For example, she would have said, "What makes a park work is that you have different people who have different schedules and different jobs and different roles." And so, when you have monocultures in cities where it's their playgrounds for the rich, they really don't even work as playgrounds for the rich anymore. They don't, because they don't work. They're not a full ecosystem.
Yeah. Kind of reminds me of those private parks that are members only in like central London that are gated off and they're only for the surrounding community. They're kind of almost like a community improvement district, but really they're the antithesis of a public park with the diversity of uses. And really it's for a single purpose. But, you know, many other communities, of course, in the U.S. have something like that, too. But yeah, we are running into time here. So with the last 3 minutes or so, Rick, if you could share with the audience where we can find you on social media and just the network at large.
Yeah. So I'm very, very active on LinkedIn right now. If you look up my name, I spell my first name R-I-K. So that's unusual enough. You should be able to find me. but R-I-K Adamski, A-D-A-M-S-K-I. And I'm also, you know, have a presence on Facebook, and I've gotten off of mostly Twitter, but you can find me on those places as well. You can also find presences for Ash and Lime, which is my company, which is, it's, you know, people think it's a construction company because those are the ingredients of Roman concrete, but it's about simple ingredients that have stood the test of time. So if you go to Ashlime, ashlime.com, you can look up more about me and my thoughts on that. Having more podcasts and webinars about this. And we also, kind of a sneak peek that we are, I'm working with a small group of people that we're going to be starting a consortium that's going to focus on strategies for vacant and underutilized storefronts in downtowns, working on generally on the scale of whole downtowns or whole districts. We're going to have some of the leading thinkers and doers in the country who are going to be part of that. So keep an eye out for that as well.
Yeah, please share the information with us so that we can share that with the audience and everything. We'd love to
help
you promote your good work. You're really kind of a leader in this space, throughout Dallas, across Texas and the U.S. So really super psyched to have you here today. Thank you for kind of joining. I would like to invite myself on your podcast when you start that up again, but we can chat offline about that or some other collaboration. I'm sure we'll find a way to kind of join forces. But Rick, thank you so much. It's been a really sincere pleasure to hear your thoughts about what you're doing from the bottom up level. I think you're doing the community and the profession a real service. It's very heartening to hear, that there's others like you in the community that are really kind of adding value and giving communities their own voice and their own inspiration. So really, thanks so much for joining us. And you can find our podcast, of course, on Spotify, as well as Amazon, Apple, and other channels. And we'll be kind of publishing this episode shortly. So thank you again, Rick, for joining us as our guest today.
Okay. Thank you so much for your kind words, Scott. And it was great being on this. And you will be on our podcast once we get it restarted again.
I look forward to that. All right. Thank you very much, Rick. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.